Listen to us online, on your phone, download a podcast, or on your tablet. Radio Gorgeous, there for you.
Lord, I feel like going home. I tried and I failed, and I'm tired and weary.
Good morning and a warm welcome to Catherine Norbury here on Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you very much for having me, Donna.
And we're talking about The Fish Ladder, which is your first book. And it has been described as a memoir come travelogue.
Yes, it's actually been described as all sorts of things. I certainly didn't think of it as a memoir when I started writing it.
And one of the things, for me, one of the stories that it is a story of daughterhood and motherhood and being adopted. And I myself was adopted and I have found my mother, so it was...
Oh, that's fascinating. Now I'm going to want to interview you, so this is hopeless.
But the book does chronicle a series of incredibly traumatic and emotional and physical events, that one of which would have knocked you for six. And through all of them, you seem to have walked your way through them.
Well, the interesting thing is that when I started writing, when I first started writing, none of them had really happened. I just had this idea that I'd spent this lovely summer with my daughter in Wales, and throughout it all, I had a strange sense of something passing or something slipping through my fingers. And so I just wanted to write an account of the summer.
Mm.
Almost as, well, as a gift for my daughter. That was really what I envisaged it as, a sort of handmade book wrapped up in, I don't know, fish skins and bits of seaweed and, you know, like a collage that I was just going to give her to keep as one of those things that you have when you get older that you can look back on. But then as I was writing, all sorts of other things got in the way, and once that began to happen, I realised that it was a book, and that actually it had a wider reach, and that I couldn't miss out the life events that were happening, and so I just incorporated them and folded them all into it. So, you know, some people have asked me, why did you choose this particular form of a travelogue to deal with this set of personal circumstances, which I know I haven't revealed yet, I started writing the travelogue, and then it just happened.
Yeah, well, where does the book start?
The book begins things. Because I mean, I am a woman of a certain age, and I had found myself pregnant. I think I was about 43 when I was pregnant. I was absolutely delighted, but then I lost the baby. And when the summer came, I realised that I should have had a baby in my arms. So this long summer that was planned, in which nothing's happening, wasn't just sort of idle indolence. It was supposed to be the first 3 months of this child's life. That's why the diary was clear, if you like. And so I found myself in Wales with my daughter Evie, who at that time was 9, with nothing to do. You know, my arms were empty. And so I felt I had to come up with a project to get us through this difficult, possibly blighted summer. Because it was so beautiful. You know, the sun was shining, the fish were jumping, the dolphins were off the coast. It was adorable. But there was this great vacuum. So I came up with the idea of following a river from the sea to the source. And that was what we set out trying to do. That's what the book's about, you know, the search for that strange, intangible something.
And quite intrepidly, because Evie was 9, and you guys do some... Like, you're a serious walker. You know, and that... The knowledge of a walker is what we get. Because me as a native New Yorker, I mean, I did grow up, we used to go on a family walk every Sunday, and we'd go to the Mayanis River Gorge, and we would go on, you know, nature walks, but not of the nature of you and your father and your family. And it's all of that knowledge of plants, of trees, and of the myths that are attached to them that we get in these accounts of your walks with your daughter, but some of them are really quite challenging.
Yeah, some of them are, and and some of them aren't. I think when you walk with somebody, you have to cut your cloth accordingly, and it can change. So although Evie was 9 years old, she's a much better climber, for example, than I am. Mm. From the age of 7 years old, she was good for 10 miles. Yeah. She has this extraordinary long loping gait. She's now a much better walker than I am.
At one point in that summer, you were staying with your mother,
mm-hmm.
And you walked near Liverpool on a beach in Liverpool. And what happened to you on that beach?
Well, when I went with my mum and my daughter Evie, we were actually revisiting Crosby Beach in Liverpool, where the artist Anthony Gormley has built this phenomenal installation of 100 life-size casts of himself. They're quite eerie and quite strange. But that was the second time that I had visited that place. The first time I'd been, the first time I'd seen the statues, I'd just been overwhelmed by this feeling that I had been born there, that this is where I came from. Now, I knew I'd been born in Liverpool. The part of Liverpool was on my birth certificate, so I knew I was roughly in the right place. But I just had this really strong feeling on the beach that day. And so I turned to these two old ladies who were walking along the sand with a little girl between them and asked them if there was a maternity hospital nearby. And they said, not anymore, but there used to be. It's now a Catholic guest house. But it was a hospital run by the nuns, and it's over there. So I walked over there, knocked on the door, and it was like Alice in Wonderland. As soon as I stepped through the door of this huge house, which was on the latch, I let myself in. I got smaller, and I could feel the familiarity of the place. I knew it. I knew I'd been there before. And it turned out that this was the place where I'd been born and abandoned by my mother at birth and stayed with the nuns, who were quite literally left holding the baby. It wasn't a Catholic mother and baby home. It wasn't somewhere geared up to abandoned children. But they kept me, and they gave me a name, which isn't the name I have now, and looked after me until a family could be found for me. And it was this extraordinary moment of recognition. I know babies aren't supposed to be able to remember early things, but as soon as I walked through the door, I recognised the stairwell, I recognised the stained glass windows. That view that you have as a small child over someone's shoulder, you know, mm-hmm. that was the view.
Radio Gorgeous.
And for you, that was an intense moment, because you had never discussed, you know, you discussed your adoption once with your parents, who were incredibly loving and, you know.
Yeah, incredibly loving and incredibly of their time, where we don't talk about anything that's uncomfortable or difficult. And so although I'd always known that I was adopted, it didn't really mean anything to me. Gradually, as the years went by, I figured out that whereas my brother had been found under a gooseberry bush, I had been found in a cradle in the church. Nobody told me that. That was just my deduction in a very, you know, I was raised on Dumbo, where the stork flies in. And so one day when I was 11 years old, I asked them, you know, who am I and where do I come from? And I could tell it was just neither of them wanted to answer the question. Mm-hmm. And it's a strange experience that many adoptees have, which is we have this curiosity. We have this life that is other. And yet I haven't met many adoptees who are comfortable speaking about it, certainly not of my generation. Mm-hmm. There's a sense of enormous gratitude to your family, which I'm not sure is entirely healthy. Most people grow up with a sense of entitlement that their mother and their father are there. And it's not something you ought to... Well, we should all be thankful for everything. It's not something you should be specifically grateful for. Mm-hmm. But there is that sense of being the foundling, being the orphan who's been taken in. I do think the word birth mother is an unhelpful euphemism that gets you around from actually a terrible truth, which is that these children are given up. Mm-hmm. And there's a violence and a trauma built into the celebration of bringing home a new baby. And mm-hmm. I think adoption is therefore deeply complex for that reason.
And somebody recently who Dorothy Kumpson, who's written a book, you know, who's not adopted, but wrote a book about adoption, and she said in exploring this, and I thought, wow, that's actually, I hadn't heard that before. But it is quite profound, because she said the adopted person's story is often the quietest one. It's the person who gave you up, their trauma, the person who found you, their joy, and also probably previous trauma of not being able to have to. So your curiosity is then, yeah, well, it's not your story. It's our story.
No, that's very perceptive, because I don't want to give the book away, but I do enter into a correspondence with my mother, birth mother, mm-hmm. call her what you will. And she had a certain set of desires and wants and needs, mm-hmm. and
They supersede yours.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually had a letter from somebody saying, you know, you were wrong to go against your birth mother's wishes in trying to find her. And I thought, well, hang on, why? Why is what she wants more important and more relevant than what I want? Surely they're equally balanced.
Mm-hmm.
And that the child story is often the unsung one. And even now, when you look at the way adoption is presented, and of course we have come on enormously in our understanding of this trauma at the heart of adoption, which I think really when I grew up in the 60s, nobody really thought of it. You mm-hmm. were just taken in. I mean, in a culture that had lived through two world wars, where people were used to loss and displacement, and where women died in childbirth, and, you know, babies were parceled around and passed around to whoever could raise them. Now, certainly in this culture, we're accustomed to thinking that the child is going, that for the most part, everything's fine, and babies don't tend to be displaced unless there's some good reason for it. So I think that adoption agencies and charities now are very cognizant of that complexity.
Whether they deal with it well or not is another story. But yeah, I mean, so
yeah,
this whole story,
it's still geared towards the adults. Yeah. It's still, you know, essentially what's happening is children are being marketed.
Mm-hmm. And we're managing their relationships.
Yeah,
it's the
adults who look after the children are looking for the adults who may look after the children. Mm-hmm. But the child is still the person whose story, for the most part, because they're children, is not really sung. And not necessarily when you become an adult. No one really wants to hear it, necessarily. Mm-hmm. Because it's always...
I think it's very common that you don't even want to hear it yourself.
Go to audioboom.com and follow Radio Gorgeous.
Having been adopted, I'm going to ask you, having your own child, was that important to you?
Yes, it was very, very important to me. I've never been able to put my finger on it, but even though my relationship with my adoptive parents was wonderful, is wonderful, with my mum, dad died many years ago, they were wonderful people. But there was always a part of me that all I knew about myself was what I saw in the mirror. Mm-hmm. And when I, you know, normally when you look at your family, you can see that they are your mirror. But for me, the glass was the only mirror. And I always thought I'd have a huge family. I thought I'd have sort of 4-6 children. And it just, that wasn't the way the cards were dealt for me. But I did eventually have this one beautiful daughter. And she means the world to me. And it was a strange thing, but I think we need contact with other people like us. It's quite basic and primal.
Mm. Yes, I remember describing that feeling. Like I remember saying to my father, saying, "I don't know anybody, and I've never met anyone who looks like me."
Yeah, well, they're my words. You know, I must have uttered them so many times.
Yeah, and my father said, "Yes, there's no one in your purview."
Well, that's an interesting phrase.
And that's
when
I learned the word purview. I was like,
yes.
Thanks, Dad. But it is true. There's no, if I look, you know, in the 180, 360 degrees around me, there isn't mm-hmm. any, now, except for my son, who's my only, you know, at that time, my only known blood relative.
Well,
and
yes, and that, again, that was my relationship. I mean, when my daughter was born, I spent hours, days, weeks just staring at her.
Mm.
You know, people would say,
really
annoying.
He just looked like him.
But he's always
just looked like him. He doesn't look like either of us. You're supposed to look like me.
Yes, but then I thought, you know, who are these people that you look like that aren't me and aren't my husband? You know, where has this nose come from? Mm-hmm. You know, whose eyebrows are these? And she was absolutely fascinating for all that she represented. And I do feel for her, because I think that must be actually quite a burden to be someone's only relative.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, The Fish Ladder, the title of the book, A Fish Ladder is... I mean, I define it at the front of the book. Can I read this?
Yes, please.
I just, in the end, thought the best way to deal with this is just to put the definition. Fish ladder, noun, a structure that allows the natural migration of fish around an obstacle, such as a dam. Most fish ladders consist of a series of pools arranged in low steps, hence the term ladder, that the fish swim and leap up to reach the open waters on the other side. The velocity of water falling over the steps has to be great enough to attract fish to the ladder, but it cannot be so great that it washes them back downstream or exhausts them to the point of inability to continue their journey upriver. And I chose that once I'd set eyes on the ladder itself at Pitlochry, because it works, it has so many resonances in my own life, not least of which was that Evie was born as a result of IVF treatment. And so for 12 years, I was trying to become pregnant. And the fish ladder, IVF is, if you like, a kind of natural fish ladder. It's a man-made solution to a
going around an obstacle.
Yeah, to going around an obstacle, which in my case was my fallopian tubes. And so that striving to achieve really what's a very natural process, in my case having a baby, was really hard fought and hard won.
Radio Gorgeous, podcasts for women.
And it did lead you to some really amazing, wonderful places in Scotland. And tell us about some of the places where you went.
Well, eventually, the river that we had in mind to follow was the Dumbeath Water in Scotland. And after a long summer of meandering and taking false turns, as rivers do, I eventually found myself in Scotland alone. I did revisit the river with Evie, but I followed this beautiful river from the sea, the little harbour town of Dumbeath in Caithness, which is really very far north. And very quickly you find yourself on the moors, and there are no trees. Once you've left the village and the woodland behind, that part of Scotland is really quite far north. There are no trees. There are the peat flows, which is just this expanse that goes on for miles and miles and miles. It's probably the least populated part of the British Isles. On the map, it was just white. I mean, I thought when I first saw my map that half of it hadn't come out because there was nothing on it. And then I sort of looked at it very closely and I could see these tiny little blue lines that looked like eyelashes, and these little sort of splinters that looked like bits of sequins. And I realised that it was a bog, and the eyelashes were the sort of tufts of grass, and the little blue bits were these things called duvlochs, which means black water. And they are exactly that, because the peat is like a sponge that opens up. It sort of cracks in the heat and open these fissures open up, and then it fills up with water. And so you can step on something that looks like a puddle and just go straight down, and that's the end of you, in that very Hound of the Baskervilles sort of way.
Yes, that, which did happen to you at one point.
Well, that did happen
later.
To me, yeah. Fortunately, I had Evie with me and there were rock, and so I didn't disappear entirely. But I did feel rather foolish having said to Evie, you know, don't step on any water without testing the depth with a stick. And I just sort of went straight down. Yeah. But you know, it was a fantastic experience, because suddenly everything is quiet, and there are just there really wasn't much sound. The sound of the wind going through the heather and the very short grasses, and not many birds because there are no trees. And that's one of the great joys of walking in Britain. You know, you couldn't do this in Wyoming, because there'd be all kinds of things that might eat you or attack you. We have no bears. We have no lynxes. We have no wolves. We just have one poisonous snake, and it's very shy of human beings. And so our landscape is extraordinarily safe. And I think that was the thing that I realised was the most enormous privilege of being able to walk. In Scotland, there's a right to roam. There are no fences. You can, or there are, but there'll be a stile for you to make your way over them. Pedestrians have a right to roam, which we don't have in England and Wales.
And then, I mean, was there this incredible sense when you found the Dumbeath, you know, source? Was that what you were thinking was you were going to feel?
Well, when I first found it, it was a bit of a shock, because I'd been following the river, which at this point was about the sort of span of two hands width, and it was really very slight, through this landscape which was beginning to flatten out but was very bleak, very austere, golden because the grasses had burnt off during the summer, with sort of heather black just turning to magenta as the bells were beginning to open up for September, with this sort of whitish bluish sky. So it was quite a monochromatic landscape in which not much happened, and I was following this tea coloured water for a long, long time without it appearing to get any smaller or any bigger, or nothing was happening to it, and then it just disappeared. It just simply vanished into a hole in the ground. Not a hole in the ground, it was a sort of area of mud. And I couldn't believe that that was it. It was so undramatic.
It's not at all. It's a bit anticlimactic.
It was very anticlimactic. So I sort of stopped and I looked at it, and I was trying to make something good of it and thinking, oh, well, you know, it's like a navel and it's just oozing this primordial soup, and that's right, that there should be nothing there because it's the start of life and there is nothing there. And much as I tried to read something into it, I was terribly disappointed. And then this mist came down, and so I sat down and thought, well, I can't move now anyway. I may as well sit still for a while. And I had this book by Neil Gunn, The Highland River, in which he talks about this same river, the river that runs through The Well at the World's End, runs through several of his novels. Mm. And so I looked at the back of the book and thought, well, what happens when the protagonist finds the river? I hadn't read it because I didn't want to have the experience secondhand. Mm. I just had it with me. And, of course, I opened it at the back and there was this description of this astonishing loch with a beautiful mountain, Morven, and a description of a white crystal beach, sand of white crystal. And I thought, this is just mad. I mean, there's no loch here and there's no mountain. I can't see anything. And then I looked at the back of the book and, of course, it said fiction. I thought, well, he's made it up. There's nothing here. And then suddenly the mist lifted. And weather can change very quickly in Scotland. So a breeze comes, you know, a cloud moves. There's the sun, blue sky. And suddenly there was the mountain. And so I started walking. I could hear the water under the ground, and I could see that there was the vegetation was different. It was, you know, the watercress, all kind of sort of aquatic plant life that I knew that it was here, and I could hear it. And so I followed this sort of green trail through the heather, and then I saw the lip of the land rise slightly. And so I walked to the bank carefully through the douvlocks, because it was like World War One up there. It was, you know, black peat with lots of sort of holes full of water. It did look as if shelling had taken place, because you are at this point on the sponge. And suddenly there it was, this absolutely beautiful lake with the blue cloud, you know, the blue sky, clouds, robin egg blue. It was exquisite. And that was a strange experience. I mean, that was like stepping through the portal into the other world. And quite humbling.
Yes, in the face of the awesomeness and the awe-inspiring aspect of nature.
Well,
you know,
I didn't do any of the things that I thought I'd do.
Source.
You know, I thought that I'd sort of swim in it or drink it or something. But actually, it felt like a very spiritual moment, and I felt that if I even disturbed the surface of the water, that it would take eternity for it to return to that place. And I didn't feel it was mine to disturb. So even though the rain and the wind must do it all the time, I just sort of sat and watched and waited for a while until the cloud came back down and the audience was over. And then I turned around.
It has been revealed to you, now
yeah,
you must go.
Exactly. It was yeah. Quite like that. The curtain was lifted for a moment and I saw something and then it went back. And I turned and retraced my steps.
Thank you so much. You've been incredibly generous. And thank you so much for being on Radio
Gorgeous.
Donna,
thank you so much for inviting me. It's been lovely and a privilege to be here.
This is a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com and beautifully edited by Ella Gray Thomas, 2015.